Well, that certainly would be a theme of several of the chapters of Blown for Good, the story of Mark Headley. We'll talk about exactly how it is that he came into and then, most importantly, how he tried to get out of Scientology and what he's here to tell us they actually are doing, including these massive compounds, which enjoy a certain amount of societal, if not police, protection from all sorts of abuses that other less powerful people or organizations would be held accountable for. And that's just the tip of what Mark will tell us coming up next, because not only did he had to blow that pop stand. He had to go. And not only has he left Scientology, but he's left with its secrets, which he'll be telling us about next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. All right, 1, 2, 3 clicks. Okay, I got the blog up. If you missed earlier, I was talking about the new movie 2012. That's in the first hour of Coast to Coast. I hope that that you heard, too, a little bit of the testimony from Margaret from Alaska. She's just one of many people out there who have had experiences with Scientology. I'm sure we'll be hearing from many more in our last hour when Mark will take some questions. The book is Blown for Good. It's so nice to have you on here. And knowing now your life story, Mark, I wonder whether I have anything to fear by having you on this show.
You know, that's funny. I was on a show the other night, and that's the exact same thing they said. I wouldn't worry too much about that. I don't think, you're high profile enough that if anything did happen, that certainly wouldn't be the best public relations move for them to have on their hands. So,
it's interesting that you say that public relations piece, because I would say of any organization that's out there, any political or religious organization, I'm guaranteed to hear from somebody from the Church of Scientology anytime it comes up in conversation. It is as though they are monitoring everywhere, or that if they have people who, you know, who are good Scientologists, that they pick up the phone and they call some central number whenever Scientology comes up for discussion. Because, you know, I've lost track of the number of folders and phone calls and pleas for you have to have us come on and we have to be able to give equal time. And I don't get that from anybody else. The Catholic Church doesn't call, you know, Islam doesn't call. I mean, nobody calls and demands, you know, the kind of time and attention that Scientology does.
Yeah, they have quite a legal and PR machine there. They actually have a group in Los Angeles. It's called the Office of Special Affairs. That same organization used to be called the Guardian's Office, and if you Google Operation Snow White or Operation Freakout, you can on the web you can find out what the Guardian's Office and OSA do for the Scientology organization. But they definitely have people monitoring radio, TV, anything comes up on Scientology, it's recorded. They put in a report's written up. Somebody contacts the show. There's a whole machine that goes into place anytime Scientology is mentioned anywhere.
So we're being recorded right now.
Oh, absolutely, without a doubt. I mean, this show. I mean, as soon as this show was going to happen, they knew about it. I mean,
okay,
there's no question about that.
They have a file on you, Mark. I'm just kidding. I know they do. So, you know, there are all sorts of aspects of your book, which I want to get to. Let's just start a little bit about your story so that people know from which you speak, that that this is something which you started with as a youngster. You went to Scientology schools. Your parents were divorced, but there was a premium that was placed on you attending these elementary schools and up. Cause you've been exposed to Scientology almost your whole life.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, pretty much as far as I can remember back, we were involved with Scientology and actually lived in Hollywood directly across the street from their Celebrity Center International, which is this huge castle-like building that they have in Hollywood. And so I was, I mean, that's where I went and played with my friends, was at the, you know, the Manor Hotel or the Celebrity Center property. And, you know, so after being in Scientology and going to the schools, I was actually recruited for the organization, which is called the Sea Organization, which that caller from Alaska brought up earlier, which is where you sign a billion-year contract. And I signed that billion-year contract when I was 16 years old. And went working at the Scientology management facility that they have in Los Angeles. And starting at 16, I was working over 100 hours a week, 7 days a week for, you know, $50 a week, basically, for Scientology. So,
And right away, that would be a red flag for a lot of other organizations out there, because even if it's a church, you can't create slave labor like that. I mean, I don't know of any other church that could get away with having somebody as technically employed, but also being paid at such a pittance. But or does it fall into the category of you're a volunteer and they're just giving you, they're winking you a little cash on the side?
Well, see, that's one of the things. Right now, I actually have a legal suit against them for recovering back wages that were unpaid. But one of the things that they say is, they say, yeah, well, we're a religion, so you're basically a religious worker and you're a volunteer and you actually signed away your rights and we can do this and we can do that. But when you look at it, when they say, well, we're just like all other religions, well, if you look at other religions and you do a little bit of investigation, you can find out that there's actually a thing called the Coalition of Religions. And pretty much any mainstream religion is part of this coalition. And they've issued, you know, a public report saying, you know, based on the various tenets of each religion, we support the living wage or the minimum wage. And in most cases, even though these people are being provided with housing and they're being provided with their food and expenses, they're also being paid a wage separate to that. And even, you know, I've done a little bit of research on this, but even like a Catholic priest who's, you know, the head of, you know, a small congregation, he can earn up to $26,000 a year as an employee of the church. In the 15 years that I worked for them, I made $29,000 total for the entire 15 years.
Well, they must have been giving you room and board.
Yeah, you're provided with room and board, and you're provided with food. They also, when you do start working there, they tell you, we're going to cover your medical, we're going to cover any expenses that might come up or that you have. But after you're working there, and in my specific case, I needed glasses, I needed contacts. In order to get that, I would just get put on a list of, you know, another 100 people or so that needed contacts. And, you know, when they got to you, they got to you. And in most cases, employees saved up their, you know, the little bit of money that they got, and they just went and bought their own contact lenses, or paid for their own glasses, or, you know, paid for a lot of the things that they say they're going to provide to you. You do end up paying for on your own. And, you know, I spent money on everything from uniform parts. You know, that's another thing. You have to wear a uniform when you're in the Sea Organization. I purchased, right, you know, tens and tens of pairs of, you know, pants and shirts and, you know, all that with my own money. Even though, you know, that's something that they say, hey, we're going to provide this. So there's a lot of different things. But even the point of, you know, you're a volunteer, there's actually a legal definition of what a volunteer is. And
right,
a volunteer can leave when he wants to leave. He can volunteer to work there, and he can decide he doesn't want to work there. And so just the fact of not being allowed to leave immediately makes you no longer a volunteer.
Well, let's get down to that then, because that is central to your experience in Blown for Good, is that you, at some point after, you know, starting at age 16, quote unquote, you know, working slash volunteering for the church, you decide this isn't for you. So why couldn't you just put down your pen and go, you know what, I'm done, I gotta go? What stopped you from being able to do that?
Okay, well, when I was promoted to the international headquarters, within probably about, I think it was about 6 months of working there, I basically said, that's it, I'm out of here. This is crazy. I don't want to work here anymore. I want to leave. I voiced that I wanted to leave. I was basically put under watch by security, and when I basically just said that, that's it, I'm walking out of here, one of the security guards that was there basically said, listen, Mark, you don't want to leave. You know, if you leave, you're going to get declared.
Explain declared, yeah.
Declared in Scientology is basically you get labeled a suppressive person, and an actual issue gets written on you, and it says suppressive person declare, and it has your name at the top of it, and it basically says that this person is no longer, you know, in Scientology, and any Scientologists are basically not allowed to speak to this person. So
okay, so what would be wrong with that? If you want to go and they want to declare you a suppressive, so what? You take your car keys and you go, right?
Well, yeah, see, it's not that easy. First of all, I didn't have a car. Here I am. At that time, I was 17 years old. My mother was a Scientologist. My sister was a Scientologist. My brother was a Scientologist. Basically anybody that I knew or had any dealings with was a Scientologist. So, yeah, sure, I can leave. And now, and if they let me leave, now I have no job, no source of income. I have no one to go to. I have no one to work for, or I'm basically starting my life, you know, however I can figure out how to do it. And at the same time, they won't even let you leave.
How do they stop you from leaving?
Well, like you just said, you can just grab your car keys and go. Okay, well, at the international headquarters, there's probably, at the time I worked there, there was anywhere from 1,000 people working there to, you know, several hundred, 800, 700 people working there. Out of all those people, I think 20 people there have vehicles. And most of the people there don't have a car. They have no means of transport. So even if you do have a car and you say, hey, I want to leave, the first thing they do is they take your car keys. You're now, they're basically saying you have to forfeit your car keys. And even if you refuse.
But how can they do that? How can they just say, you give us your car keys?
That's the way it is.
So do two burly guys come up in, you know, in orange jumpsuits and say, give us your car keys? I mean, or do they,
no,
how do they just take your car keys?
Usually it would be security personnel. In my case, we'll jump a little bit forward, but in my case, later on, there were several times that I was there that I was deemed a security risk. At the time, I had a motorcycle, and I had two keys to my motorcycle. Well, my motorcycle was parked on the property, and I was placed on this security risk list, and a security guard came and took the key out of my motorcycle. So when I went to go get on the bike, I couldn't even drive my own motorcycle, which I mainly use just to drive around the property because it's a, you know, it's a 500-acre property. It's not a small place to get around on. So, but I had another key. So it was like, yeah, okay, whatever. You took that key. I got another key, buddy.
Right.
So I drove my bike around a little bit more. The next time I went to go get on my bike, obviously after that, I would take the key out. I wouldn't just leave the key in it.
Right.
Park somewhere. They put the biggest chain link chain and lock on the bike that I'd ever seen. It was literally something that you would
I don't even know
what you would use a chain like this for.
Right, like for a boat or something. Anchor.
Yeah, exactly. It was literally like a mooring line to a cruise ship, and it was wrapped around my motorcycle, and I was like, you've got to be kidding me, you know? Now I've got a key. Whoop-de-doo. It's not going to do anything. They've chained it up. So they also, the property is gated. So at this specific location in Gilman Hot Springs, the entire property is surrounded by 6-foot-high fences that have what's called ultra barrier on top of them. So
what would that be?
Barrier is basically like barbed wire on steroids. It's razor barbed wire strips, and those barbed wire strips face inward to the property, and if you try to climb over, it's very little chance you're going to get over without injuring yourself.
Are there guys with machine guns?
Well, there's a lot of folklore and there's a lot of stuff on the internet about the machine guns. And yes, they do have guns there on the property. The security force does have guns. They actually have, a lot of people don't know this, but there's actually a full-blown shooting range on the property above. At the very high end of the property, up where they just recently built a huge mansion for L. Ron Hubbard when he comes back. They built him a huge mansion so that he can live there. And there's a shooting range directly adjacent to this huge estate that they've built for him. So they do have weapons there. I've never seen anyone use the weapons other than, you know, just carrying them on there as a sidearm.
Okay. So back when you're pulling back the lens a little bit, back when you were 16, 17, you were deciding, you know, this isn't for me. You didn't have any other place to go. Your family would have to have given you up as dead, essentially as a suppressive, cut off all contact with you, and you couldn't go anywhere. Were there at any time were there armed security personnel then that were intimidating you? Or why couldn't you have just said, you know, I may be living on the street, but living on the street is better than this.
Yeah, well, okay, so yeah, we'll talk about that, because if you do leave, and this is one of the things you witness when you're there, when I was there, I was there for 15 years. I heard or saw or was witness to hundreds of people that escaped from the property. In a lot of those cases, those people are recaptured and brought back. So it's one of those things, okay, I want to leave, but they won't let me leave. If I do get out of here, what am I going to do? And if I do get out of here, what are the chances of being recaptured and brought back anyway? And then once you do get captured and brought back, then that starts the real hell of being there, because now everyone knows you've tried to escape. And if you did escape, then everybody knows that. And then you're considered someone who's blown but then been recovered. So in most cases, you end up going to what's called the Rehabilitation Project Force, which is like basically like a hard labor camp where you spend a lot of the day doing physical labor, and then you do like 5 hours a day doing Scientology interrogations, what's called sec checking, or interrogations basically, or counseling that's done on the e-meter, which is like I think this caller that brought up earlier from Alaska, right, where they ask you questions and they basically probe into whatever thoughts you had of leaving. Why did you want to leave? Where were you going to go when you left? Any and all intentions that you had. And in the case of people being recovered, what they actually do is they have a whole drill that goes into place. So if someone, and I detail this out thoroughly in the book, but right, when somebody leaves, first of all, they have three or four, depending on where and the facility that you're at. But at the international headquarters, they would have anywhere from three to four roll calls a day, where all of the staff are accounted for. Usually takes place at morning, lunch, dinner, and a lot of the times at the very end of the night. So at regular intervals throughout the day, they're going to know if someone's missing or not, because they're counting every single person. And if someone's not there, you have to say exactly where they are and who's with them and so on. So if someone is unaccounted for, this drill, what's called a blow drill, is put into place. So when we come back from the break, I can tell you more about that.
See, I love that. When a guest already knows it's time to go, that's very good. I like the kind of self-guest management. I wish everybody were that compliant. When we return to the subject, Mark Headley will explain. Ready for this, Mark? Write these down. What the meaning, the many meanings of the title, Blown for Good. I want you to explain that. And then also, we'll get to some of your celebrity encounters.
Okay.
I'd love for you to explain what actually the e-meter is. What does the e-meter do? And then also coming up on Coast to Coast, we'll talk more about then once Mark has decided to stay, all of the things that he still experiences before he is finally blown for good behind the Iron Curtain of Scientology. And yes, if they're monitoring us right now at Scientology, Punnett has two N's and two T's, and my Thetan's name is Bob. So there you go. Back for more, and your questions and comments coming up toward the end of the show on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So it's one of those nights when I'm not exactly sure what's going to happen when we get to the caller segment, although there are some bets being taken online. I just happened to click onto a forum called Why We Protest, which is monitoring this program right now. In fact, they've built an entire drinking game around this. I'll explain that, and we'll get back to being blown for good next with Mark Headley on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So, Mark Headley, the author of Blown for Good, Behind the Iron Curtain of Scientology, we'll get back to the story as we were telling it. And by the way, you tell it very well in the book.
Well, thank you.
First-time author, right?
Yeah.
That's really good. It's told clearly. It's told well. You should be very proud of that. There's a lot of people who, you know, like to pretend that they are professional authors who don't tell stories nearly as well as that. And so, good job. This is there's a forum called Why We Protest. Do you know about that?
Yeah, I'm actually on there right now. There's that forum. There's also another forum called ESMB, the ex-Scientologist message board. So they're monitoring this. There's another one called Operation Clambake, and the Why We Protest.
They've made it a drinking game.
Yeah, I say basically so much that some of the people that are taking a shot every time I say that are going to get really plowed tonight. So.
Okay. Yeah. If they're, you know, the challenge is on. Here's the drinking game. They said one drink for every time Ian Punnett tries playing devil's advocate to defend Scientology. I wasn't planning on doing a ton of that, but I am now. But it's interesting to me because, I mean, I don't know that that even though I've been in conversations with Scientologists over the years, and I try to understand this what seemed like almost a kind of a pathological need for secrecy. I tried to look at that as openly as I could. I've never gotten it. And so it was really helpful for me to read your book and be able to have a much better understanding of that psychology or that manipulation of psychology anyway. So let's get back to this. First, explain the title, The Many Different Understandings of Blown for Good. What do you mean by that?
Okay, well, blown actually, there's a slang definition for blow, which means to leave or depart. And within Scientology, the word blow basically means if you leave without authorization. So if you leave from anything in Scientology, if you're just a member doing a course in, you know, Canada or in Wichita or wherever, and you stop doing the course and you refuse to come back, you're considered blown from the course or blown from the organization. So
They don't follow up. No salesman will call. I mean, that's it. You're out. You're out. And they don't drive around your house or anything like that after.
Oh, no. When you leave, you're going to get phone calls for the rest of time and constantly until you come back. And I've talked to people that have left Scientology they've been gone for over a decade. They still get mail from the Scientology organization saying, come in and do the course. And, you know, how is it going? You haven't been here in a while. I mean, it's just, you know, somebody mentioned that to me the other day, and I said, you have to write on the mail that you get dead or deceased,
right?
You know, and then mail it back to them. And then usually they'll take you off. If you're dead, then you're dead, you know.
Mark, don't miss that. I knew the answer to that, but I framed it like devil's advocacy to make those people in the forum drink.
Oh, good,
so that's
good,
why
good.
I framed it. They had to take another shot because I asked it that way.
Yeah.
So blown in that way, then not just, you know, we're gonna get out of here, but also then in the formal sense of blown for good, and then of course in a broader sense, you're kind of blowing for good a lot of the secrets that the Church of Scientology would prefer that you kept to yourself.
Yeah, exactly. And another thing is, when I first left, I was still, you know, fearful of the organization and what would happen to me when I left. So I kept my mouth shut for a little while. And then when I left, like I said earlier, I was paid $29,000 for 15 years worth of 100-hour work weeks, which averages out to about 39 cents an hour. When I left, I was handed a bill for $62,000, which is called a freeloader bill, which basically they're now saying I owe them for the Scientology training that I got while I was there, the on-the-job training. My wife, who actually escaped about 2 or 3 weeks after I did, was given a bill for $92,000. So shortly after I left, I was having to start my life from scratch with nothing. And here I had a $150,000 debt to the organization that I spent the last 15 years slaving for. So after a little bit, I started to kind of, you know, poke around, find a few things here on the internet. And, you know, I saw a lot of stuff on the internet, which basically was just, you know, a lot of trash talk and a lot of, you know, Scientology's bad and Scientology's this, but there wasn't a lot of facts. And there wasn't a lot of, like, this is what actually occurs within the organization. So I started posting on this whyweprotest.net and Operation Clambake and ex-Scientologist message board. And I still was posting anonymously because I didn't want them to know who I was, because I didn't want, I was still fearful about what was going to happen. And I posted under the username of Blown for Good. And that was kind of what I came to be known as, BFG or Blown for Good.
Right.
And part of the reason why I picked that name is that, like I was saying earlier, when people blow, a lot of times, pretty much most of the time, they get recovered and brought back. And I wanted them to know that I was blown for good. I wasn't now, coming back.
Now, legally speaking, I know that there have been a lot of court cases about this where people originally were kidnapped, so to speak, by families and then deprogrammed from Scientology. And then they lost lawsuits on that as being they even prosecuted for kidnapping. And then plus there were lawsuits for families for doing that. That these, once you're an adult, you make these decisions for better, for worse. And this is a decision that you make. How can anybody in Scientology re-kidnap somebody, if you will? How can they turn around and through any other means bring people back to the compound? How do they do that? But by force? Are they, you know, throwing a blanket over somebody and stuffing them in the back of a black sedan? How do they do that?
Well, I've heard any and all methods of means on how they get people back. But I mean, I know one girl who left. She actually climbed over the fence at the property, at the far edge of the property, and she just started walking down the highway. And they sent somebody off to go run after her. And then she was talking to them, and they were walking down the highway with her. And then a car pulled up. They grabbed her, and they threw her in the car, and they drove her back. So there was that version. There's other versions of people being hunted down at airports. And, you know, and they do this whole song and dance, like, you know, you really don't ever want to speak to your family ever again. And you really, you're going to be out there, and what are you going to do? You don't have any money. You don't have anything. Where are you going to go? How are you going to live? How are you going to eat? You're just going to end up being a bum on the street. You know, they play into the whole, basically all the indoctrination that you've gotten over the years. They play, they put that into force and into action. And, you know, a lot of times they'll convince people to come back, and a lot of times they'll basically use maybe the spouse, maybe somebody left, but they left their wife there, and then they'll use the wife. Hey, you got to tell them to come back, and, you know,
right,
you got to convince them. And even in some cases, where both spouses wanted to leave, but one actually had the guts to do it and then did so, they've brought one spouse back, or attempted to get one spouse back. And in the course of that, the other spouse basically that was still there said, you know, screw this, I'm out of here. And then they leave, and then they get the other person back saying, oh, your husband really wants you to come back. And they get back, the husband's gone. He left to go get the wife, or to go be with the wife. And now she's there and the husband's gone. It's, you know, it's, there's an entire insanity that goes on when people leave, in terms of, you know, checking the airports. And I mean, they have their own ticketing agent there for all the major airlines. So
what?
They have their own ticketing agent computer system there at the property. So if you want to fly on American Airlines, if we're going to fly out to open a new facility or put on some kind of convention or event, all the tickets are purchased and processed there at the property. They can actually print out airline. They have access to any and all flight records for any. If the airplane's got an engine on it, they can find out who's on the flight.
Okay, but so what? I mean, lots of companies have. See, this is another drink. So what? Lots of companies have these in-house travel agencies.
Sure.
So what's different about that?
So when Joe Blow leaves and goes to the airport, they don't necessarily know what flight he's going to be on. Where's he going? They look in his file. They go, okay, good. His family that's not in Scientology lives in Denver. Boom. Okay, there's an American Airlines flight to Denver at 2:32. There's one from American. There's one from, you know, there's a Northwest. Okay, good. those are the flights we're going to check. Boom, there he is. Hey, he's in the lounge waiting. Good. Come on, we're going back to the property. They know.
They'll send somebody to the airport to find him there and look for that person.
Absolutely. This happened a few months ago. There was a kid at the Clearwater, Florida facility that left. This kid didn't tell anybody he was leaving. He just disappeared and left. He had a layover. His flight had a layover in an airport on the way to where he was going. And when he was going to go on the next flight, he was on standby and he missed the flight. But how could he be on standby? He purchased the ticket through, but somehow he ended up on standby. He then missed the next flight, and then he ended up having to stay there overnight. The next morning, his mom, who worked in the Los Angeles facility of the Scientology organization, showed up at the airport hotel that he was staying in. He had not even spoken to her, and no one knew he was there. But somehow, he showed up, and bingo, his mom showed up there, and then she intercepted him, and they brought him back.
How about that?
So, I mean, that's one of those things.
Yeah, I see that.
Did they use the credit card? Did they use the flight records? Who knows? But they found him, and they brought him back.
We're talking with Mark Headley, author of Blown for Good, Behind the Iron Curtain of Scientology. All right, Mark, so tell us about the E-meter. What exactly is it? It is like a just a polygraph machine with a fancy name, or what is it?
What it is it's a very the one that they use right now. It's a very crude electronic device that basically passes electronic signal through your body, and it's very, very low voltage, and they basically say that it measures thought resistance, or it measures the electronic result of your thoughts. And when you have a thought, it'll register on the dial. It's got it's got a needle dial on it that, the signal's passing through your body. You have a thought, and they're saying that thought is registering on the meter. It's this carrier wave that's flowing through your body, goes back into the meter, and then it shows up whatever you're thinking. So it is probably a close cousin to the lie detector. I know the lie detector has other aspects of it. It's not just the electrical conductance that it uses, but basically that's what it is. It's very, very crude. I mean, even now, there's a lot of people that have left Scientology that have made computerized USB versions of it, and
really?
People have built their own little boxes, and the E-meter itself was built by a guy. His name was Matheson. The original E-meter that L. Ron Hubbard used was built by a guy who had nothing to do with Scientology. It was basically his version of how they could, do like the next level of psychoanalysis, or it was almost even like a novelty, like a party game kind of thing, like check
right.
it out, But and then Hubbard eventually went on to copy however you want to say it, make a different version of Matheson's meter. And now they have, it's all plastic, and it's, when you open it up, it's just a bunch of circuit boards patched together. But, even those, they're making those E-meters the ones they make right now that they're making at the international headquarters, that's where they actually make the E-meters that people use in Scientology right now. They cost about $400 to make, and they charge Scientologists $3,500 each for these things.
Right.
And and they've built another 30,000 that they haven't released yet, and those were built in Japan for $40 each, and they're going to sell those for $3,500 too. So, it's a money making thing,
How high up did you get within Scientology? Talk about the levels inside of Scientology and where you ranked before you left.
I didn't achieve any sort of rank of anything when I was there for 15 years working for them. I wasn't. Partaking in the Scientology training or counseling to any large degree. I haven't even read the book Dianetics, so I don't really, really get into talking about the philosophy of Scientology. And
right.
And I also believe that people are free to believe whatever they want to believe. I can respect that. If somebody believes that, space aliens from 75 million years ago are inhabiting their body, then that's their decision. But So I didn't get, I mean, I didn't even achieve the level of clear, which is kind of like the first milestone, so to speak, in Scientology counseling, which is where you rid your body of, or your mind of the reactive mind, and now you're, you know, you're in control over what you do and what you say, and then you can then move on to the next set of levels, which are called Operating Satan Level 1 through 8. And they supposedly are going to release another 8. I think it goes all the way up to OT level 16. Right now, they've only released up to Operating Satan level 8. But so I never did any of that because, you know, I was working. I was you know, I was making stuff that they could sell. I wasn't getting auditing or counseling that much.
Right, and I know at some point when you were in school, you were going through some of those early introductory levels and that sort of thing of Scientology. I don't know. I don't remember if I read this part. How far any of your other family members got?
Well, my wife got up to OT5, Operating Level Satan 5. My mom, I think, got up to OT3 or something like that. And
what about Claire?
Yeah, that's my wife, Claire.
Right. Okay,
She got up to OT5 within the organization.
Right, okay. And then what does that mean? What would that qualify her for?
It's not really like it qualifies you. They have all these, you know, digested, you know, statements of once you get to this level, you you regain the ability to communicate with anybody about anything. And then you get to this level and you're free from the past effects of drugs in your life. And, you know, each one has its own, tag that goes with it. And it doesn't act, it's not like if you're OT5, you know, you now get to ride the Scientology bus for half price. It doesn't, there's no thing that goes with it. It's just, you know, you've achieved that level. And basically the whole idea is to keep going and keep getting more counseling until you can get all the way to the top. And the definition of an operating Satan is somebody who is cause over matter, energy, space, and time. That's the definition of an operating Satan. So within the organization, it's pretty much believed that anything that happens anywhere, you're control over. Even to the fact that, I talk about this in the book, but in 1990, there was a huge flood, a flash flood that occurred at the international headquarters. And this was just a very short time period before Tom Cruise was going to come and stay at the facility. And the mountain literally, there was a huge mudslide, and the mud literally covered the highway, thoroughly destroyed a lot of the property, and there was buildings that were full of mud, and it was a disaster. David Miscavige, who's the current leader of Scientology, he actually assigned the entire property and all of the staff there a condition of confusion for causing the flood. And this is like a penalty thing within Scientology. Right. So, he literally said we caused the flood.
All right. So that brings us back to a couple of things I want to get to, which is as best as you can explain the theology of Scientology for people who don't know it. I want to talk about their understanding of Jesus for people who see the emblem of Scientology and think that it's a Christian-like religion. And then I want to talk about some of your celebrity encounters and then also getting out and your story of how you did. A little bit more on that coming up. It's an amazing story of being blown for good. Mark Headley on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.